Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton. The website is weekendinterviewshow.com. We keep all the archives there. It's January the 29th, 2005, 4 o'clock Central Time, which means it's 1 a.m. Sunday, Election Day, in Baghdad. Here to discuss the situation in Iraq and how it got that way is Jude Winiski. Mr. Winiski is a former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal and economic advisor to Ronald Reagan. He is the founder and chairman of Polyconomics, which advises corporate and financial strategists on possible effects of politics on stock and bond markets. He writes the regular column Memo on the Margin, which you can find, along with his supply-side university, at winiski.com. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure. What exactly is on the ballot in this Iraqi election, and where's the smart money on the results?
Well, that's something that, you know, I'm not going to be able to, I don't know who's going to win what. All I know is I think that the whole thing has been, the election is misfiring because it was planned several months ago in a way that attempted to keep the United States control of the government. In other words, from the Iraqi point of view, the election's been rigged. Because they have, you can vote for slates of candidates, and all the people at the top of the slates of candidates are people that are friendly to the United States government. So this is why President Bush, although he said a couple days ago that, you know, if they ask us to leave Iraq, of course we'll leave. But he thinks that they're going to ask us to stay because they're going to want our help for, you know, the foreseeable future. And I think he's saying the latter because, you know, the expectation is that a week or 10 days from now, we're going to find that the National Assembly that is being elected to write the Constitution is one that we know in advance is going to be favorable to us and is going to say, well, stick around.
I wonder what would happen if somehow we really did make democracies throughout the Middle East. Would they vote for people friendly to the United States?
Well, that's a big question, depending upon what the United States, how the United States behaves toward the Middle East. Now, this is a question of why did the Middle Eastern Islamic countries provide the al-Qaeda terrorists and insurgents that blew up the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and 9/11. So you're asking questions that are covering a lot of ground, Scott, and you know, why don't we pick out some narrower point that I can deal with.
All right. Well, it is often said, and in fact you quoted the New York Times to this effect in a column last week, that because the weapons of mass destruction hunt in Iraq failed, they fell back on the excuse of creating democracy in the Middle East. But isn't it the case that the real reason for the invasion was to begin the process of remaking the Middle East, and it was the weapons of mass destruction that was the real smokescreen, not the liberation?
Well, the real reason, you know, goes back a long, long time. I mean, 25, 30 years ago.
Well, you got 45 seconds. No, I'm just kidding.
45 seconds. Well, Ed, my old friends, we call them the neocons, and these are the people who really have been in control of foreign policy for the last 4 years of the Bush administration, and even during the Clinton administration, they have enormous influence in Washington because the neocons are both Democrats and Republicans. Richard Perle, who is right now the leader of the neocons, was an assistant to Senator Scoop Jackson of the state of Washington years ago.
The Democrat. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back on the Weekend Interview Show. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and the guest is Jude Winiski. Before we went to break, under the heading of the real reasons for invading Iraq, sir, you were saying the neocons in the Republican Party are Scoop Jackson Democrats.
Well, no, I'm saying that these old friends of mine, and I was a neocon. In fact, a neocon is someone who used to be a liberal and has become a conservative. That's what a neocon, the term neocon means. It's a new conservative. And I was, for most of my life, a liberal Democrat. And back in the late Nixon years and in the Ford and then the Reagan years especially, I decided to switch parties. And I became a neocon. Now, we should really go back here for your viewers, your listeners, and set a broader stage, because I'm going to be on here for an hour, you say, Scott, so we can get the kind of paint the backdrop to this picture by pointing out that this all this that's happening in the Middle East and Iraq has to do with the fact that when the Cold War ended in 1992, 1993, the United States was all alone in the world as a superpower. We had defeated in the early part of the 20th century monarchy. We had then defeated communism. Fascism with Hitler and Mussolini, and then we had defeated communism. So we're a unipolar country, and the problem for us is now we're scratching our heads. Here we are alone at the top of the whole world, and it's the first time since Adam and Eve that there haven't been competing powers at the top struggling for dominance. So how do we manage the world? And there's been one group of people, and that's my old neocon friends, say we should really, you know, kick butt. And anyone who does disagrees with us, or anyone we suspect is not going to go along with us in this unipolar world, we have the power, we have the might, just slap them into shape. And this is what I've come to call, instead of Uncle Sam, Uncle Bully. Now, I have had the view that while it is necessary to have a disciplinarian at the top, it's also necessary to have a diplomacy. And I've said it's more like a family unit where the father is always standing there with the strap saying, if Junior doesn't shape up, we're going to whip him into shape. But mommy says, now hold on now, you know, give the kid a chance and we'll see if we can't work this out peacefully where you don't have to beat him. And this is where we now come to the war in Iraq is that President Bush wound up being persuaded by the neocons that Saddam Hussein was a junior in the world family of nations who couldn't be disciplined with diplomacy, who wouldn't come around with diplomacy, and he had to be whipped into shape. So now we have a war which I opposed. You know that, Scott.
Yeah.
And I opposed the war because I saw that when the United Nations and the UN Security Council has passed Resolution 1441 demanding that Saddam Hussein let all the inspectors go anywhere they wanted and look under the bed in his palace and look in any place where anyone suspected he might have a weapon of mass destruction. And when they did that, and they thought we would find weapons of mass destruction, but the inspectors combed the country. Thousands of them went in. They found nothing. And still, George Bush, President Bush, was still pushed by the neocons saying, well, we don't trust the United Nations. And we're going to independently go into Iraq. And that's where we're stuck now, because the people of Iraq, you know, have known that the problems over the last 15 years that we've had with Iraq have nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction and have everything to do with the neocons. And here I'm talking about Vice President Cheney, and I'm talking about Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. These are old friends of mine. These are people I used to sit down, and it was Don and Dick and Jude and, have dinner, have lunches, and they know me really, but I have come around. I broke broke with them because they remained warriors. Where I said, hey, the Cold War's ended. Now I'm going to be, instead of being a warrior with you guys, I'm going to be a diplomat. And so where do we go from here?
Well, so I think the conclusion of where you're going there is that the weapons of mass destruction were nothing but a pretext, that the neocons knew good and well that they really didn't have weapons of mass destruction, but they wanted for the United States to conquer that country anyway.
Well, this
and
is
my question
the
is
idea
why?
Of, this is an idea of if we're going to manage the world, now we have to manage the world. We have, there is, there has to be an American, quote, empire, unquote. And I agree with that. But how is the American empire going to, how do we manage the family of nations? Do we manage it or do we police it? The neocons saying, hey, we police it. And we use the power that we have through our military, and, you know, no questions asked, or we shoot first and ask questions afterward. That's where they've come from.
So this is really the same argument that's being had between, say, Brzezinski and Scowcroft and Cheney and the neoconservatives. Is they all want some version of American empire, but Brzezinski and Scowcroft maybe are a little less belligerent. Is that it?
It's that, you know, the way I would put it is that when you're in a real war, force comes first and diplomacy comes second. It's like they say, all's fair in love and war. And you can cheat. If you're at war, you can absolutely deceive and mislead and cheat because your objective is to defeat the enemy. Now, when you're not at war, when you're at peace, then diplomacy comes first to prevent war from happening because war is very expensive and diplomacy, relatively, is very cheap. And this is the argument that I had with my old friends. But they came to see what they have in mind, though, is more than just one single little incident, a piece of the world in the Middle East. What they have in mind is having outposts like an American Legion in every corner of the world, with American soldiers and Marines and Air Force, even if they're small. That's their vision, and that we're going to be around the world, and anytime someone acts up and does stuff that we don't like, we're going to be able there to slap them down. And we could do it, you know, with Iraq, because Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. We had defeated Iraq in the Gulf War of 91. Their armed forces were, you know, a small shadow of what they were at the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 88, we did this because the neocons persuaded our president and Dick Cheney, the vice president, you know, was part of the problem we had, saying we don't care if the United Nations and their inspectors say there's nothing going on in Iraq, and the International Atomic Energy Agency said we know for sure that there's no nuclear weapons there. There's no they have no chemical weapons, they have no biological weapons, and they have not been able to reconstitute those weapons since we've had our inspectors in there. And this is what the UN said, and still the president felt, well, we were going, because of 9/11, he had rationalized in his own mind that it was incumbent upon our country to take no chances and go in and remove this threat to the world. Now, the president never had in mind, I don't think, he's not been thinking of a grand scheme where we're going to post people all over the planet, but he allowed himself to be snookered by the neocons into doing this. And now, in his second term, I think he, because he came so close to being defeated last November, he has made some changes in policy that maybe are going to put a more diplomatic foot forward, and that we will be able to see a way of getting out of Iraq. We'll be able to see a way of solving the half century, really much longer than that, problem between the Arabs and the Israelis, which is really one of the is really at the source of the difficulties we're having in the Middle East. And you know, the year 2005, I hope I can see a light at the end of the tunnel, and things will work out, and we'll get our troops out of Iraq, and we'll have a better day.
What's happened that makes you think that the neocons' influence is waning and the realists are moving back to the forefront?
Well, I can, when I see that, now I have written, you know, Scott, that I think Condoleezza Rice, our new Secretary of State, is incompetent. Now, people have been yelling at me on my website because I say, well, she's smart, she's bright, she's bright. I'm saying, look, I am smart. And I am, I have a high IQ, and I mean, I'm 68 years old. Remind viewers of that I'm not saying this as a kid with self-aggrandizement, but I'll also say when I sit down at the piano, I am incompetent. You know, I have no competence in playing the violin.
But you
That's
would be
I
a much better Secretary
was,
of State than her.
Pardon me. But Condoleezza Rice is absolutely brilliant when it comes to teaching Russian at Stanford University and being provost of the Stanford University. But when it comes to being national security advisor, which she was picked by the neocons to go into that post and then to go to Treasury.
I'm sorry. Hold it right there, Mr. Winiski. We'll be right back on the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and the guest is Jude Winiski. His website is winiski.com. That's WANNISKI.com. He writes the memo on the margin and teaches supply-side economics. So look him up at winiski.com. Now, when we were going out to break, sir, we were talking about Condoleezza Rice and how she might be talented at some things, but being a national security advisor is not one of them.
Well, you know, what... They, I said, Condoleezza Rice was essentially picked by the neocons back when she was at Stanford University years ago, and she was brought into the administration of George Bush the First when Brent Scowcroft was National Security Advisor, and it was George Shultz, former Secretary of State, who is you know, one of the war party, one of the warriors. Got her in as kind of a protege to Brent Scowcroft in the first Bush term. Then she went back to Stanford and became the provost. And at the and back in 1999, here's George W. Bush is governor of California, governor of Texas, and he people come to him and say. Governor Bush, we think you should run for president. And he says, well, you know, I have, you know, interest in politics. I know kind of how to be running Texas, but I have no influence, interest in knowledge in foreign policy. And they say, well, we have just the person for you. And she's a very attractive woman from California. And she's a brilliant, speaks Russian, blah, 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 blah. Her name is Condi Rice. And she, they bring her down to Crawford at the ranch and introduce her to the president. And the president says, gee, she's really nice. I like to deal with her. She's very pleasant and very knowledgeable and blah, blah, blah. And then she says, Mr. President, you should meet someone I think you should know that will help me in foreign policy and teach you how to run the world. And his name is Paul Wolfowitz. So Wolfowitz goes in to Crawford. And there's a picture of them in the New York Times, President Condi introducing Wolfie to the president. Then Governor Bush. I mean, we're back in 1999.
Well, she's Scowcroft's protege. Why is she so friendly with the neoconservatives?
Well, he wasn't really a protege. He did George Shultz a favor of bringing her in and having her sit there at the National Security Council. I don't know what she was doing back then, sharpening pencils or what. But she was never really Brent Gorbachev's protege. She was always George Shultz's and Richard Perle's protege.
Well, so what do you make of the fact that...
But the newspapers, you can't believe what you read in the newspapers, Scott. You know that as much as I do. And but then Wolfowitz is there for a couple of weeks, and then he says, Governor Bush, I think you should meet my friend, Richard Perle. So Perle flies down to Crawford. And the next thing you know, they have totally control. They have lassoed him. They have lassoed the governor, and he is now committed. They tried to minimize the influence that Colin Powell had, because Colin Powell was not a neocon. Colin Powell had been always, even though a general of the army, said, hey, look, we're not at war. Let's put diplomacy first. Not only in dealing with the Arabs and Israelis and with Saddam Hussein, but also with the Iranians, also with the North Koreans, that we should be able to find some way to resolve our differences so we don't have to spend another $100 billion, $200 billion, $300 billion per year at the Pentagon, and also have to throw our young men and women into harm's way and have them ground up as cannon fodder, as they have been in Iraq. So this is where we've been over the last several years, and how we're trying to now, you know, get our way out of the mess that was made in Iraq by the mistakes made in the last 4 years. And I think the president is creeping his way out of this. And then Condi Rice, the reason I'm hopeful, is when I see that she has brought in as her deputy Secretary of State, even though she herself is not competent to be Secretary of State, she's smart enough to bring in Robert Zoellick, Z-O-E-L-L-I-C-K, Zoellick. And Zoellick was the deputy to Secretary of State James Baker III, who was a terrific Secretary of State. He was a good Secretary of the Treasury, and he's not a neocon. He understands the how to use diplomacy when diplomacy can get the job done, and that's Bob Zoellick.
Well,
the other person. The other person is John Bolton, who had been at the State Department over the last 4 years, a maniac. Every time the North Koreans wanted to try and do a deal with us, or the Iranians wanted to try to do a deal with us, Bolton would say, no, we don't want to make a deal with them because they're rogue states, and we want to blow them up. In other words, these are warriors. That's what they do. They want to have wars, and they want to create provocations to make things difficult for diplomacy to work, so they can get their friends in the munitions industry to say, okay, we're going to need to spend so much more on this and that and the other thing. And there's money is made that way too. A lot of this is money.
Well, Mr. Winiski, I can think of a couple of different spins on the fact that Bolton is out and there's no neocons in the Pentagon anymore, or in the State Department anymore. One of those being that the realists are finally getting their power back. The other being that there's no neocons necessary in the State Department because Rice is neocon enough. But we'll get back to that right after this break. It's the Weekend Interview Show. The guest is Jude Winiski.
Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is Jude Winiski. And read what he writes at Winiski.com. And Mr. Winiski, some would say that the split between the realists, or Rockefeller Republicans, and the neoconservatives is really being greatly exaggerated. After all, if Wall Street really didn't approve of this foreign policy, couldn't they just have it called off in a day?
Well, as Wall Street is not... running the government, there is a political establishment, and the political establishment are the group of people who are involved in all aspects of U.S. Dominance in the world, and a lot of that has to do with money. But they don't run everything. I say it's probably located in Washington, in the American Enterprise Institute, a think tank that is probably most closely associated with the Republican view of how to run the world and is linked into what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. They're financed by all the major arms manufacturers, and that's a primary motive, because those people, they will do anything to make money. And if the government says, well, we have a problem in the world, and we have to have a war, or we have to have anti-missile defense system that's going to blow up missiles coming in from us from North Korea when North Korea doesn't have any such missiles. Well, you know, all that becomes very confusing, and the politicians in the Congress, Democrats and Republicans, wind up at various times not arguing over it and coming to terms in a way that produces bad results. Now, the bad results wind up with budget deficits that are sky high, or the United States trying to manage things without any allies. And this is one of the problems, one of the brighter spots that we've had over the last 4 years of errors that we've made. We don't have any friends in the world. Even the Tony Blair in the UK now is having so much trouble because of how he committed himself to President Bush over the war in Iraq, that he can't go any further. And the rest of the family of nations is more or less gathering itself together to say, look, Daddy, in Washington, the United States, we're not going to go along with you anymore, and we're going to cause you problems unless you listen to us more, pay more attention to what we're saying, so that we can straighten things out. And I think that's really what we can expect in the balance of 2005 going forward. I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to do that. You mentioned before the break, Scott, that they said, well, with Condi Rice as Secretary of State, the neocons have all they need because Colin Powell is gone. But I think, as I said, because Bob Zoellick is there as number two, that this is a different wing of the Republican Party that has been given this kind of influence, and I'm expecting good things from it.
Well, I sure hope you're right about that.
Well, I do too.
I don't know that
the
I'm optimism.
Right. I don't know that I'm right. You know, I have my fingers crossed, and it's something that this is what I do for my Wall Street clients, and also the subscribers to my investment service, which some of your audience may be interested in, but they can find out about that at Wineski.com. But I have to follow these things on a daily basis. I'm on the phone every day to Washington because the forces of darkness never sleep. The neocons haven't given up. They're every day burning the midnight oil, trying to figure out how to make an American empire according to their own lights, and to have their own people in charge, and to take on bigger and bigger responsibilities. The next, you know as well as I do, all the talk there is of opening up another front against the Iranians. Now, do we need, now that we're so wrapped up in Iraq with no end in sight, do we want to go to war with Iran, or do we want to help Israel go in and bomb out Iran, a country three times the size of Iraq? You know, all those things, if those negative things happen, we'll be going in a downward spiral in our national economy and in the global economy. But right now, I have a sense of optimism. But my sense of optimism will only last for 24 hours if I see something else happen tomorrow or the day after. This is why I can't... I've been trying to retire for the last 3 or 4 years and write books and travel the world, but I can't. I can't leave go while there's so much at stake here.
Absolutely not, because I need my memo on the margin in my mailbox in the morning. Now, here's the confusing part, though, because I sat down this morning and I was trying my hardest to remember all of the neoconservatives in the U.S. government. I know there's a lot in mass media, but the only ones I could think of actually inside the U.S. government are Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Scooter Libby, Bill Luddy, Abram Shulsky, and John Bolton. Who am I missing? This is a handful of guys to be determining a gigantic policy.
Well, you have people, you know, in every... Richard Perle, I said, when he was... He was 25 years old is when I met him. This is going, we're going back to 1969. And Perle worked for Scoop Jackson, and he's a Democrat. And Perle, back then, was a socialist. He's still a registered Democrat, by the way. And he met a young man that then worked for Senator John Stennis of Mississippi, another Democrat, named Jim Woolsey. And Woolsey...
Clinton's director of Central Intelligence for a time.
Was Clinton's... That's right. And see, and Clinton never knew who Woolsey was, but because of Perle's influence, pulling strings when Bill Clinton was elected president of the United States from Arkansas and had no idea who should be a CIA director, you know, he showed up, was sworn in as president, and said, well, who do you guys have in mind for me as being CIA director? And he said, we have the perfect guy for you, Jim Woolsey. And Clinton met with him once and said, I never want to meet with that guy again, because he could tell right up front that there's something wrong with Woolsey, and Woolsey is just a stooge. He's part of this whole network of people. You're saying there's only a few people that you can identify.
Inside the government, anyway.
Well, I'm talking about inside the government, there's staff people. There's staff people that are throughout the government. And if you, there are 535 members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, 435 members of the House, 100 senators. If you go and check their staffs, you'll find that two-thirds of every member of Congress, Democrat and Republican, has someone handling their national security affairs that is tied into the Perle neocon network. Oh, you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
And that is power. Power comes not because you just have the person at the top. It comes when you have the people at the staff level.
Well, what is it about an ex-leftist turned right-winger that makes them all such warmongers, with the exception of you?
Well, no, there are a lot of us who aren't. Most of the people who came, the Reaganauts, are a different breed of cat. And people, I don't know if you know the name Doug Bandow.
Afraid not.
Okay, Jim Pinkerton.
Oh yeah. I actually like some of the things I've read by him lately.
Well, Pinkerton, I met Pinkerton when he was just out of college back in 1979. When I was coming to advise Ronald Reagan on his race for the presidency. And that's why I met Doug Bandow and a whole group of kids who are now writing syndicated columns. But in the Reagan years, they worked for Ronald Reagan in the executive office building and various aspects of policymaking. So those people opposed the war in Iraq because they could see that the neocons had their own interests and their own strategy for running the world. Now, when I'm talking about running the world, it's something we have to do. There's no question about it. The United States has to manage the world.
Why?
Because we're at the top, and there's nobody. If we don't do it, somebody else has to. Somebody else will come emerge, and people are already worried now. I'm reading stuff today. China is going to grow so fast, 1.2 billion people, at the rate they're growing, 9% a year, blah, 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 blah. By the year 2050, they're going to be twice the size we have. They're going to be twice the military, twice the power. You know, in other words, competition never ends. History doesn't come to a close.
Well, see, that all sounds like great reasons to not run the world, but in fact, to just be a nice customer and business partner with the world.
But there, the issues, I'm talking about running, I shouldn't say running, I should say managing. Managing means, and this is my argument, this goes back 15 years, when I saw that the Cold War was ending and that there was going to be this kind of debate on how to manage the world, I said it's no longer a left-right proposition. Left-right is when you have the United States versus the USSR or the United States versus Nazi Germany. But when there's a unipolar world, then it's no longer horizontal in terms of the conflicts that arise intellectually. It's now a vertical. And when you see a vertical in the unipolar world, the most appropriate way of thinking about how to manage the world is a family unit, how to think of mother and father.
But, Jude, wouldn't, for public relations purposes and dealing with the rest of the world, isn't this, well, maybe it's too late now, but it seems to me like this is the perfect time for America to say, hey, world, watch us. We're the most powerful empire ever, and yet we renounce it. And we don't want empire. We only want peace and commerce and friendly relations with all nations and entangling alliances with none.
But when you think of empire, you know, I'm thinking of bad empire. If you know, I don't know if you've gone to my, if you go to my website, you'll find an essay there I wrote back in 1994 called An American Empire. And it writes about how we are an empire. There's no way we can escape that fact, but what kind of an empire are we going to be? I don't mind the word empire. I grew up in the Empire State. New York is called the Empire State. And
It seems to imply coercion. It seems to imply that hey, you're going to trade with us whether you want to or not.
Well, no, but when I'm talking about is a family that has discussions about when should we use force and when should we not use force. And this is what the United Nations was established for back in 1945. You know, I was 10 years old back then, and I've always thought of the United Nations as a place where differences could be discussed and the whole world can come together in New York and give their opinion about how things should be managed.
And, you know, I always thought of the UN as the kind of organization that I would approve of if it was what you said, a place for representatives of all the nations to come together and discuss things in hopes of avoiding violent conflict. But really, the more I study about the United Nations, the more it seems really like a weak federal government of the world. And I don't want a federal government of the world.
Well, yeah, but one of the things you have to acknowledge, Scott, is that 1945, we had been through really terrible, bloody wars, and World War One and World War Two, and then here we are facing the USSR, and thinking that we may have to have World War Three, and we'd all get blown up in the process with nuclear weapons. But now, all of that, a peaceful resolution of the conflicts that we had with communism ended without a nuclear war or a World War III. Yes, there were some battles that were fought in Vietnam and in North Korea, but essentially, because the United Nations was meeting and talking and yapping and back and forth, and there were these discussions going on, they said, it's just a big debating society, things were sorted out. So the United Nations now has a different meaning and a different process than when we were confronting the Soviet Union. Because while we were confronting the Soviet Union would get their allies inside the United Nations, and we would get our allies, and we would bribe them, and they would bribe them, and we would move back and forth. But all of that is over. We have a whole new problem for us in, quote, managing the world. And the United Nations is something that could fulfill that function the way it was supposed to back in 1945. So I have hope that a reformation of the UN to fit the times will work. And if we look back on the year 2003, it was working perfectly. The United Nations worked exactly as it was supposed to do when it first came out, and 15-0, the Security Council said, hey, let's force Iraq to allow weapons inspectors to come in. And if they don't, we're going to go in and do something about it.
But, Jude, this is my whole problem, is that the UN, and I know you're saying that they went and they did their inspections and they said there's no reason for a war, and we went ahead and had one anyway, but our government used Resolution 1441 as its authorization. George Bush said we're going to enforce this UN resolution whether they want it enforced or not.
Well,
the UN
is the excuse for
the American Empire, is it not?
President Bush used the resolution he got from the United States, from the Congress. He also misused the resolutions. You know, he went to ask the House and the Representative, House and the Senate back in 2001 to give him authorization to go to war against Iraq if diplomacy failed. And that's what they gave him. And he went to the, and he had, in order to, for President Bush to get that, those votes from the Congress, including the vote of John Kerry, by the way, Senator Kerry, he had to promise that he would go to the United Nations and that diplomacy would fail in the United Nations, then he would go to war. Well, we went to the United Nations. The United Nations then undertook the process of working things out, and it did it to complete satisfaction, but still President Bush, this is why Kofi Annan, the General Secretary of the United Nations, said the United Nations was acted in a criminal international fashion. It broke the law. It broke the international law. And I believe that we did. And I believe President Bush did. But and this is now why, afterward, he says, whoops, you know, because President Bush was snookered. I mean, President Bush didn't do these things because he's a bad guy and he lies and cheats and
what a fool. All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back to wrap up. It's Jude Winiski on the Weekend Interview Show. All right, my friends, we're wrapping up the Weekend Interview Show for January the 29th, 2005. The guest this hour is Jude Winiski. And I just got an advanced copy of a new book that's coming out, I believe, in May, called Neocon, the first chapter of which is an interview with Mr. Winiski. And, sir, in that chapter, you seem to be making the case that the U.S. government knew good and well all along that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq after 1991. Is that right?
Well, even when you say the U.S. government knew, the U.S. government includes everyone in the executive branch, everyone in the congressional legislative branch.
Well, okay, how about the people that mattered knew?
That I'm saying that there were the people, the neocons, and this is why the book is called Neocon, is the name of the book, that there were people. And I'm talking about the Defense Policy Board, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Vice President Cheney. They, for the most part, really they had the information. They had sufficient information that there were no weapons of mass destruction that were going to be found in Iraq, and that it was a nuisance for them to have to go through the United Nations, because what their real intent was to establish Iraq as an imperial outpost of the United States, that we would have our troops there forever, and that our troops inside Baghdad, when we take over that government, we'd have a puppet government there, would keep peace in the Middle East, and we'd be there to protect Israel against any threats that would come to it from the Iranians or the Syrians or whoever, and we would do the same kind of thing in Korea and in Iran and in Libya or anywhere in the world in the process of erecting this an American empire.
You also
this is the book is all about, and we might have gotten into some of the discussion about how they went about demonizing Saddam Hussein. Now, your listeners will probably be at this, we only have a few minutes left, shocked to learn that, I don't think Saddam Hussein was nearly the bad guy that they believe him to be from reading the press, the national press, the American press, over these last 15 years.
I was just going to say, Mr. Winiski, that in reading that interview, you really absolutely demolish every casus belli they've ever hurled at this guy. Every excuse they've ever had for warring against Iraq, you basically just take apart into little pieces, right?
Yeah, and one of the things that you and I talked about before the program that I mentioned and have written about recently is this issue of religious freedom. Remember, Iraq is the most secular of all of the Islamic states.
It was.
And under Saddam Hussein, under the Ba'ath Party. It had been, and I mentioned that Tom Friedman of the New York Times 3 or 4 years ago had written about how Saddam Hussein had expelled every last Jew from Iraq. And I know Tom Friedman, and I read him and said, this is false. Why are you writing this? There's still functioning synagogues in Iraq. And the reason that there had been 200,000 Jews in Iraq, and they've been part of that whole civilization going back for thousands of years, when you wind up having the New York Times saying something, all the other newspapers fall into line, and then the television stations fall into line, and it really is only on the margin here and there, programs like yours or the alternative press that can push back and try and get some truth back into why it is that we're making the policies.
And speaking of which, go to Wyniski.com and read the memo on the margin. See you next week.